Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
That was Joyce Lindorf, our regular musical interlude that introduces our show. You know, I very seldom talk on Secular Sunday, as many of you know. That's probably why the show is the most popular, averaging 400 to 700 downloads a week, because you don't hear me blathering on about things. And I took this special time because at the very beginning, one, so I won't interrupt the program throughout the next two and a half hours, to announce two important crises, financial crises, taking place that will affect Radio Free Kansas. One, Free Speech Radio News has till March 15th to raise another $5,000-$10,000 just to stay on the air after the 15th. It's still in question. And a blowtorch radio station, an institution, WBAI out of New York City, they have an antenna that broadcasts a 150-mile radius around New York City on top of the Empire State Building. And they've announced just this week that they need to raise $250,000 to pay for the rent for that antenna on top of the Empire State Building. WBAI has been broadcasting for decades out of the New York City area and is one of the community radio stations that deserves our support. Why? Because you have repeatedly listened. If you listen to Radio Free Kansas regularly, you will know Robert Knight's 5 o'clock shadow and Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg's Building Bridges, the Community Labor Report, are both broadcast regularly, weekly, on Radio Free Kansas, especially you of Ray McGovern, who regularly starts off his articles from Bob Perry's Consortium News. Ray McGovern has appeared frequently on WBAI's Robert Knight's 5 o'clock shadow. So, and I've replayed and broadcast. It's a way we stay in contact with Ray McGovern through WBAI. So I encourage listeners of Secular Sunday, I assume you're intelligent. I assume you're listening to my programming that I select because you must be intelligent. You must be literate and appreciate good books and classical literature. I'm asking you, go to WBAI.org and FSRN.org and make donations in any amount to both those fine institutions, and thank you for putting up with my announcement. Now, on with the show. We'll begin up with Catherine Stewart's Good News Club, how the Christian right in a stealth operation on America's children and the public school system.
Hello. Welcome to New Books in Secularism, a podcast where we talk to authors about their new secularism-themed books. I'm your hostess, Annie Sepulcaya, and today we are going to talk to Catherine Stewart, author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. Catherine is a journalist and author who has recently written for The New York Times, Reuters, The Guardian, and Alternet. In this book, she shares the important research she has done on Good News Clubs, which are a ministry of the Child Evangelism Fellowship. She found in her research that though they portray themselves as a benign after-school Bible study program, they are actually aggressively and purposely sectarian. Their real goal, she discovers, is to sneak into and create a stronghold in public schools, to push their brand of religion through peer-to-peer proselytizing, and ultimately to take back public schools for Christ, while promoting discrimination and divisiveness along the way. Thank you so much for being on our show. Today we are talking about your book, The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. So in this book, you pretty much argue that The Good News Club isn't good news at all. So what is this club and how did you come to know of it?
Well, I first learned about the club, the Good News Clubs, when I was living in Santa Barbara, California. I had a daughter in kindergarten and my little boy was about a year old. And I learned that a group calling itself the Good News Club was coming to our public elementary school. And the group acquired parental permission to join and called itself Bible Study from a non-denominational perspective. And my first thought was that this just wasn't a big deal. I figured, you know, let the parents who want their kids to learn about the Bible sign them up. You know, I'm a strong supporter of free speech. And I also support the idea of teaching the Bible in public schools from a non-sectarian standpoint, as history or literature or anthropology. But then I started to hear stories from parents around town whose kids went to schools where Good News Clubs had recently been established. Apparently there are 4 Good News Clubs in town already. And I started to hear stories about how kids attending the club, and we're talking about little kids here, they would start going to the club, and then they'd start targeting their peers for what I can only describe as faith-based bullying. I want to tell you a story about a little girl we knew, Zoe. She was on the playground when her 6-year-old classmate, Ashley, came up to her and said, "You don't believe in Jesus, so you're going to go to hell." Now, Ashley had just started attending a Good News Club, and she determined that Zoe was a member of a minority faith that didn't believe in Jesus. So Zoe looked at her little 6-year-old friend and said, "Well, that's not true." And things got a little heated. The girl started to argue, and their teacher overheard the exchange and decided to use this as a teachable moment. Different religions, she explained to the kids, have different perspectives on these different issues. So Zoe was fine with this. But Ashley, the little girl attending a Good News Club, she was devastated. She started to cry. She said, how can that be? How can they lie to us in school? I know it must be true because they taught it to me in school, and they don't teach things in school that aren't true. How can they lie to us in school? Now, this little exchange gets to the heart of the trouble with the Good News Clubs. I don't have a problem with kids talking about the religion with their friends at school, but I do have a problem with Ashley believing that her particular religious beliefs are sanctioned by and endorsed by the public school. And I began to realize that that perception on Ashley's part is no accident. It soon became clear to me that the real purpose of Good News Clubs, which are have a very fundamentalist take on Christianity, they're sort of in that fundamentalist strand, they seek to convey the false but totally unavoidable impression in very young kids that their religion is endorsed by the public school. And that's why they're so insistent on establishing themselves in public schools. Good News Clubs at our school and others come into the school often before the bell rings with treats and balloons and laying out spreads of cupcakes and candy. They know very well that little kids cannot distinguish between an activity that takes place in a school and one that is sponsored by the school. Frankly, as a parent, when I looked at all the after-school activities until the arrival of the Good News Club, I just assumed they were all sanctioned by and had the stamp of approval of the public school. I figured that's why they're in the school, because the school must want them to be here.
Right.
In fact, many public schools, including ours in Santa Barbara, really did not welcome the arrival of Good News Club to our after-school program. In fact,
this is not something that came out of a spontaneous expression of faith from the community.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's hard to know exactly how they arrived, but because often what Good News Clubs do, Good News Clubs are, by the way, sponsored by an organization called the Child Evangelism Fellowship. And how they typically work is that they partner with a church that's sort of theologically aligned with their mission. And the church members get their kids, who are already, by the way, attending church and getting religious instruction in the church, to be the first group of Good News Club's kids at that school. But at our public school, which actually had a very large evangelical population, a number of families who are, you know, evangelical families, they really thought the Good News Club was not right for our public school, because we had a very small public school, very diverse in terms of religion. All the different Christian denominations, some Jews, some Muslims, some Buddhists, non-theists, and they knew that the Good News Club's arrival would not be welcome news for most of us in the community. So they met with the Good News Club leaders before the Good News Club leaders came to our public school, and they said, may we offer you, they said, we know you mean well, you know, we agree with you, you know, theologically, but you're just not right for our public school. But we'd like to offer you free space, and actually better space, in this beautiful evangelical church, literally next door to the school. I mean, the entrance was 40 feet away. It was Montecito Covenant Church. It's probably one of the most beautiful evangelical churches in America. I wish you could see a picture of this gorgeous church in the Spanish style, with sun-splashed, you know, white stucco and beautiful gardens. I mean, who wouldn't want to be in that church? And the Good News Club leaders declined, saying that the public school was where they wanted to be. And they know very well that by being in the public school, they're going to not only make kids think that the religion that they're preaching is endorsed by the school, but they're going to use the proximity of other kids to try to convert them. At every Good News Club training I attended, kids were offered points and prizes and sometimes even candy for recruiting their peers to the club. And this seems to be the part of the Good News Clubs that's most disturbing to parents. Look, I don't have a problem with people, you know, inculcating their children and their form of faith, but I do have a problem with them using the public school to tell their kids to go out and try and, you know, recruit my kids or other kids to the club. In fact, a father who attended one of my events in Pasadena, California, he and another woman had just attended the first Good News Club training, session in their kids' public school. And the teacher was telling the kids at that school, now, if you want to live, you need to believe in Jesus. And I want you to go right now to the playground and find a friend and tell them that if they want to live, they need to believe in Jesus. And then you come back here and tell me what happened. So the Good News Club leaders are actually using the kids attending the clubs to try to recruit their peers.
Wow, that's appalling. And how do they get away with this? I mean, isn't there a separation of church and state?
Well, what happened to the separation of church and state? That's a good question. This is all the result of a 2001 Supreme Court decision in which it's called Good News Club versus Milford Central School, in which the courts ruled that the activities of the Good News Club are really protected by the free speech clause of the First Amendment. In doing so, they basically said that, you know, the establishment clause of the, you know, First Amendment, which is Congress should make no law respecting an establishment of religion, which is typically used to mean there should be no to bar government funding or endorsing of religion, they have been basically eviscerated. They ruled that these religious activities in the public schools are protected, that religion is nothing more than speech from a certain viewpoint, and therefore these religious activities in the schools are protected by the free speech clause of the First Amendment. Now, is religion nothing more than speech? I don't think so. I think most people recognize that religion is not more than speech, and you know who recognized that? It's our founding fathers. And that's why they inserted two distinct and separate clauses in the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, which recognize religion as something other than speech. Our tax code doesn't say that religion is nothing more than speech. That's why religions have significant tax benefits, parsonage exemptions, and other kinds of financial benefits that other forms of speech don't have. Our legal code doesn't see religion as nothing more than speech, and that's why religious groups don't have to abide by the same anti-discrimination laws, for instance, that other for-profit and non-profit groups do. And, you know, more to the point, religions are free to preach the kind of doctrines, such as the idea that, you know, same-sex relationships are a so-called abomination, which rightly keep them free of government institutions. But in this particular case, 2001, Good News Club versus Milford Central School, it was a divided decision, by the way, the courts did rule that, you know, it was convenient for the majority, Scalia and Thomas, et cetera, to say that religion is not really religion at all, it's just speech. And therefore, it's opened the doors to this form of religious activity in the public schools. Now, I think, of course, people are entitled to their religion. They have a right to practice it, but they're not entitled to a government institution in the form of the public schools through which to promote it. It's a heavy government subsidy, and it's basically conflating the idea of the public education with a particular form of religion, and it's had dire consequences in our public schools.
You said that public schools were originally created to keep these problems kind of out of this, you know, public discourse because there were so many different religions and so much variety in America.
Well, right in the very beginning of the public schools, you know, in the very beginning of our country, schools were community run or privately run, and therefore often ruled by the particular Protestant denomination that that community sort of belonged to. But as soon as public funds began to be used for education, what form of the Protestant religion was a matter of great controversy. Congregationalists quickly tried to take control of the public schools, and Episcopalians and Lutherans and other groups sort of fought back. They were very unhappy with this situation, and there's a law in the books actually dating from 1827, which says that the public funds cannot be used to purchase textbooks that favor any particular sectarian agenda. Now, back then they were talking about sort of pan-sectarianism within the Protestant agenda, but let's remember, I mean, that was people fought wars over Protestant sectarianism back then. I mean, this was no easy matter. There was some, you know, obviously there was prayer in the public schools at that point, but it was very kind of watered down. Horace Mann, who founded the public schools, was himself, he had converted from Calvinism to a kind of Unitarianism. Mm-hmm. So he sort of saw this as a kind of, you know, universal values which would not offend any particular sectarian sensibility. Now, that proved workable in our country for some time until Catholics started to immigrate in large numbers. Mm-hmm. And then it was, you know, all heck broke loose. I mean, people fought and died in the streets over this issue. In Philadelphia, a couple of dozen people were slaughtered over fights about whether Catholics being barred from teaching their form of religion in the public schools and using their Bible and their form of the commandments. And in Boston, a little boy, Thomas Wall, was told by his priest not to read from the Protestant Bible. Mm-hmm. And so when he was ordered to do so by his teachers, he refused. He was beaten for 30 minutes. And the next day, 400 of his schoolmates walked out of the school in protest and in support of him. And as a result of this situation and some others that were very similar to it, Catholics, at no small expense, decided to start their own system of parochial education. Lutherans had done the same because they didn't like the form of the Protestant faith that was being taught in the public schools, and they wanted to establish schools where their children could kind of be tutored in their particular form of faith. And so you see over throughout our history that even when the majority of children attending schools were Christian of one denomination or another, the role of religion has always been heavily contentious. And now, of course, we have, you know, so many different faiths in our country and people of no faith at all. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, most people have arrived at the very sensible conclusion that public schools should be non-sectarian, which is to say they neither favor nor disfavor any particular form of the faith. And for that, you know, by doing that, we keep the public schools, you know, safe places and welcome places for all.
You mentioned earlier about textbooks. What is the deal with them? Because I thought that they were more, I guess that there are the more of a variety of them, but you said that most of them are actually made in Texas?
No, the textbooks aren't made in Texas, but textbook mm-hmm. publishers write their textbooks to conform to the standards of the largest purchasers of textbooks. And the three largest purchasers have typically been California, Florida, and Texas. Now, right now, California and Florida don't have money to purchase new textbooks. They're suffering terrible budget cuts with their education system. So Texas is currently the largest purchaser of textbooks. And so textbook publishers are writing they want to write their textbooks to conform to the standards of Texas so that Texas will purchase their textbooks. And that's, so what happens in Texas doesn't end up staying in Texas. And the Texas State Board of Education has been dominated by a far-right faction that has a very particular religious and political agenda. And so I attended the hearings of the State Board of Education around textbook curricula to sort of watch and see what kind of standards they were trying to push through and that the standards that were going to be, you know, taught through the, you know, for the rest of the country as well. And what I saw is that the far-right faction made so many changes in the areas of the social studies and history, and each change. I'll give you a couple of examples. They demoted Thomas Jefferson and people like him who were not Orthodox members of Orthodox believers of Christianity, they rejected a motion to sort of teach the separation of church and state. They changed the name of every time the word democracy is mentioned, it was changed to constitutional republic. They mandated teaching people like Phyllis Schlafly and William F. Buckley or organizations like the NRA. They kind of reconfigured the social studies curriculum and the history curriculum with a kind of Christian, you know, they tried to impose a kind of Christian nationalist slant on the teaching of history, and they tried to impose a kind of, and they did succeed in imposing a kind of political slant on the teaching of history and the social studies. And each particular change they made wasn't itself like so horrible, but there were so many of them, it was sort of like death by a thousand paper cuts.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And you said also that they, for example, they try to, you know, rewrite history, and along that same vein, they try to kind of make it seem in their curriculum, I guess, well, it's not their curriculum, but in their views, that the state and church separation doesn't actually exist, that it's been exaggerated by liberals.
Well, this sort of far-right faction, then other people they represent really don't believe in the separation of church and state. They would like to ignore the letter from the Danbury Baptists, for instance, to Thomas Jefferson. They would like to demote. They in order for them to believe that the separation of church and state doesn't exist, they have to basically ignore many of our founding fathers, demote them. They have to demote people like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams and Benjamin Franklin and certain writings by, you know, even George Washington. And they, of course, they have to completely ignore people like Ethan Allen and Thomas Young, who are so instrumental in the sort of philosophical origins of the American Revolution, because those people did not want to establish America as a Christian nation. In fact, they were adamant that America's government should be secular. And of course, they want to elevate anyone they can find who took a more orthodox view of the Christian faith. And look, the fact is, our country was founded by a diverse group of people who had diverse approaches toward religion. But what they did is that they established America as a secular nation, and not they explicitly didn't want the establishment of a religious government. And the far right's faction of the board, in order to kind of promote their agenda, they would like to, you know, ignore those facts of American history.
What is the role of school vouchers in all of this? How does school vouchers help their agenda?
School vouchers siphon money from the public education system and divert it to private schools, many of which are religious. And it's been shown that many of the schools that the voucher money, that tax money is now funding, they use textbooks from organizations like Bob Jones University and Abeka. They promote creationism. They teach something called biblical math. They promote very disrespectful attitudes towards people of other faiths, and they also promote a kind of Christian nationalist version of American history. Now, you know, vouchers are called, part of the school choice movement. Now, choice is a word that we all like, progressives and liberals especially like it. We all want to believe that we have choices, and we all like the idea of parents having a say in their children's education. But the problem is, school vouchers do siphon money from the public school system, thereby weakening it. And also, they end up going to fund religious establishments, which I believe is a violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
When you did this research, you attended a lot of conferences and you spent a lot of time with these people. Was it difficult to go by unnoticed? Or, I mean, did you go by unnoticed? Did they know that you were not one of them? Like, was that strange?
No. I mean, you know, when people would ask me what church I belong to, I would tell them truthfully that my family is affiliated with an Episcopalian church, because I did send both of my children to an Episcopalian preschool, and my son was attending the preschool at that time. Is a really great little school. I just went places where people are allowed to go. I mean, people just, people make a lot of assumptions. I just sat in the audience with everybody else, and, I didn't need to announce myself as a non-believer, because, frankly, I think there's a diversity of approach to belief within any of these organizations. I think there are a lot of people who are constantly questioning their faith or not really believing, even though they're attending these churches. So, sure, I wasn't the only non-believer in the audience, but, or non-subscriber to their particular theology.
Right.
But, I just went places where people are allowed to go and watched what was happening, and it was really interesting. I mean, some of the stuff I just couldn't quite believe. I had to tape record everything so that I could go back and mean, is this really what I'm hearing? And you know, of course, have the book fact-checked and everything else.
Wow. Yeah. Is there anything that you saw in these different schools, and I guess in your children's school, with parents fighting back? Like, did that work at all?
Unfortunately, what happens when a Good News Club, I write about this in my book, when a Good News Club comes to a diverse community and parents get upset, it just creates tremendous division within that community. I have a chapter about a community in Loyal Heights, Seattle, where Good News Club arrived, and a lot of parents were very upset about it. Some of them are religious, some of them are Christian, some of them are Buddhist, some Jewish, some not religious, some Catholic. This sort of coalition of parents who really didn't like it at all, and they were very upset about this. And they were not able to keep the Good News Club out of their public school. They were able to, in some ways, kind of limit the scope of their activities and limit the place that they were, you know. But when I visited Loyal Heights, can I tell you, I went there to see the Good News Club in action. And all the clubs after school were meeting in the big lunchroom. Where all the clubs meet right after school, you know. And the Good News, you know, all the kids, there's a science club, there's an art club. Good News Club's there. They have laid out, I cannot tell you the volume of sugar on the table. I mean, all the kids in the entire room looking like, oh, my gosh, these kids are getting double stuffed Oreos and chocolate chip cookies and gummy worms and, you know, and candy and Capri Sun coolers. And, I mean, it was just unbelievable. They really make this table look incredibly attractive to little kids. What do little kids like? Little kids like candy, you know? I mean, frankly, I wouldn't, you know, I'm not one of those anti-sugar moms, but I try and keep it at a minimum, but there was no restraint at this table. I mean, this table is completely laden with treats. And so they really make it attractive to other kids. All the kids could kind of see that you know, and that seems to me to be part of the manipulation of children, you know, try and get them in with candy and treats and then tell them that, you know, they're going to go to hell unless they subscribe to a particular, religious ideology.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned something called the 4:14 window. Could you just tell us what that is?
When I was doing my research and going to festivals of missionaries, I discovered something called the 4:14 window. It's the title of a book written by one of the high-level thinkers in the mission world. His name is Louise Bush. And some years ago, he came up with a strategy called the 10:40 window. Now, 10:40 was between, you know, 10 and 40 north longitude, that part of the globe where the most, they call them, unreached people groups live, sort of swaths of Africa and the Middle East. And he's a kind of high-level thinker in that world of evangelical mission. And he said, we get to focus on the 10:40 window. So hundreds, thousands of missionaries were dispatched to that part of the world to establish evangelical churches and convert those, quote, unreached people groups. Now, in 2009, he sort of switched focus. He said, it's not about the 10:40 window anymore. It's about the 4:14 window, meaning children between the ages of 4 and...
everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very happy to have Adrian Goldsworthy on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, How Rome Fell, Death of a Superpower. This is, of course, the classic historical question. That is, why did the Roman Empire fall? And as you may know, there are many, many, many explanations. The difficulty, of course, is that when you have a lot of explanations, you don't have any satisfying explanation. And that's what makes Adrian's book so terrific. He boils it all down to what is really quite a sensible account of the events that led the late Roman Empire to fall in the 5th century. I won't tell you exactly what the explanation is. It becomes clear in the course of the interview, but I will say that it focuses on the kind of nitty-gritty details of Roman politics, which, of course, are always fascinating. They've often been treated in fiction. I don't see why, because, in fact, they were amazing. You know, he pays a lot of attention to Roman political culture. He also talks a little bit about the comparison, which is often made between the United States today and the Roman Empire then. There have been a number of books that have treated this subject. We had a short discussion about it, and I think you'll find it entertaining. Adrian's not a big fan of these comparisons. I really enjoyed my discussion with Adrian today, and I think you'll enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Fine, thanks.
Now, you are someplace in the UK, correct?
Yes, I'm in South Wales, over in the west.
South Wales. I don't believe I've ever been to Wales. I hear it's beautiful, though.
Some of it is, yes. Today it's raining, cloudy, and but we're on the coast. We've got nice seaside, and yeah. Mountains not far to the north, so it's quite pleasant.
Yeah, that sounds very nice. No, we have overcast skies here in central United States as well,
right.
And we have no ocean and no hills. I should tell our listeners that we have Adrian Goldsworthy on the show today, and we'll be discussing his terrific new book, How Rome Fell, Death of a Superpower. As all the listeners to this show will know, I have read the book. One of the great pleasures of doing this program is that I get to read all these fantastic books, and this is a really interesting and terrific read. One of the things that occurred to me while I was reading the book is that there's a lot of there have been many fictional treatments of Roman politics, and it's kind of hard to understand why, because Roman politics don't really need to be elaborated in order to be incredibly interesting. And Adrian does a terrific job of kind of fleshing that out. There's lots of human drama in this book. And, of course, there's a ton of really terrific historical analysis. But before we get to the discussion of the book itself, Adrian, let me ask you to say a few words about your own life. That is, where you were born, where you went to school, how you became interested in history and that sort of thing.
Well, I was actually born a few miles away from where I live now, just in the city of Cardiff in South Wales, and grew up here apart from about 7 years at Oxford at university. It happened the first university job I got was back in Cardiff, so, and then writing took off, so I've pretty much been here ever since. Mm-hmm. So very much stayed in the hometown and that area because it's a nice part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Went to school locally, went to a small boys' school where we were taught in a very traditional, old-fashioned way that was effective but not terribly exciting. But it meant that I had to learn Latin from a young age, which is, you know, a big asset later on, rather than Greek. I had to learn at university because when I was about 12, we were given the choice of learning ancient Greek, but it meant staying in at lunchtime and not going out and not kicking a football around or doing something like that. So at that age, I decided it was better to go out for lunch rather than have a lesson in Greek. So I had to learn that as a student when I went off to Oxford. But probably the hard way. So I suppose the interest in history just has always been there. It is a nice thing about Britain that you've got so many sites all around you. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got a castle in Cardiff that's 12th century.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, particularly, the interest in the Romans came because the Romans were here as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Roman legionary fortress, or the remains of it, an amphitheater just about 20 miles to the east of where I live. So I remember pestering my parents to take me there all the time as a kid. And it was, you know, the Greeks, the Egyptians, it's all very well, but they weren't here.
Mm-hmm.
I could go to things that the Romans had built, and I could scramble over them, and I could touch them, and that just seemed to bring it to life so much more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I can certainly understand that. I lived for a time and taught in Ireland, and I remember, I remember there would be things that would be hundreds and hundreds of years old, and I would look, and I would be with my Irish friends, and I'd say, look at that old castle over there, and they'd say, what old castle? Yeah, right. There, yeah. But, you know, this is older than anything I've ever seen in the United States. I mean, not that there aren't, you know, things of great antiquity here.
Oh, yeah.
But there's nothing like what they had laying around in Ireland, just everywhere. And but the Irish just didn't really notice it because it was part of the landscape. But it fascinated me, and I was wanted to go explore these things. And they were like, they'll probably tear it down and put up a new chip shop or something.
Yeah, it's the same, really, for most people. But I don't know. It's just one of those things that history is always fascinated and excited me. And I think even as well, and perhaps the reason I've done quite a lot of military history is I grew up, my father had been in the latter stage of the Second World War. He ran a small shop, which in Britain, shops acquire people, lots of old men who don't have anywhere else to go, and they sort of sit around and talk, and to the point where everyone thinks they must be employed, but they just turn up. And there were lots of the people who'd been soldiers in India and Burma and all over the world or in the Air Force. So I heard all these stories growing up, and it just makes you interested in not just the past, but the people. You know, it isn't just the great events. It's what it meant for the individuals to be there, and that's the approach I've tried to take as far as possible to ancient history, even though obviously it's much more difficult there. Yeah.
But before we launch off into a discussion of the book, again, let me take another small digression since you mentioned it. A lot of the listeners to this program, I think, are they were what we call here in the United States history majors, or are interested in writing history, or they are or were academics and are interested in writing for a popular audience. And you and some of the other people who I've interviewed on the show have successfully made that, I would call it a leap. I'm not sure everybody would, but I would call it a leap from academia into popular writing. Can you talk a little bit about how you negotiated that and how you had to adjust the way you write and the kind of topics you chose and that sort of thing?
It certainly is. It's a leap. I mean, I had the good fortune in that even when I was doing my doctorate, my supervisor was very keen on writing well, which was a fairly unusual thing there, and tried to tell you to, you know, don't make it look like a thesis, make it look like a book. So I reckon by academic standards that some of the stuff I wrote then was at least passably readable. But the first popular book I did, I got a contract to write a coffee table illustrated book on Roman warfare. And it was part of a series that John Keegan, the famous military historian, was editing. And, for instance, there were something like 3 or 4 volumes just covering the Second World War. And I got 1 volume to cover 1,000 years of Roman military history in 40,000 words and 100 illustrations. And it meant that I think it was either the 4th or the 5th draft I wrote, just to get it down to size, because that word limit was tight. But it made me think very much from the start about what was truly important, what you need to explain. And the big mistake always to make is to assume people know quite a lot already. Have to be prepared to explain. And really, in the end, though, I think it's something that it's best to try and remember what got you so excited about history in the first place. And if you turn to that, and if you talk to plenty of people who are interested casually, perhaps in a different period, wandering around, say, a historical site with them and just chatting is a good way of getting an idea of what people know and what interests them. So there's a lot of, and through teaching and you know, all of these things in a different way, it's being aware of the audience. If you write purely for the few dozen or few hundred other people who are specialists in your field, then that's fine and you're aware of that. But the things that will fascinate them, the minutiae, the detail, it's just too much to cope with for a wider readership. And I remember one of the first books I did after Roman Warfare was a thing on the Punic Wars, and I'd written a sort of introductory chapter that was straight out of really how I would have done things for an academic book. So I surveyed the modern scholarship on the subject, and, you know, there were pages and pages of so-and-so says this, and then in response, such and such said that. And the editor asked me out to lunch up in London. And so, you know, essentially, well, who are these people and why should I care about them?
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And just explained how, you know, you can get the same ideas across, but a lot of the information you can push into the notes or the bibliography.
Yeah.
And in the end, it's like a conversation. You know, you need to communicate with the reader, and that's what it's about. You don't have to simplify the ideas, but you just have to present them in a way that is interesting when all said and done, which to some extent in academia you don't have to do because everyone's interested in the first place.
Yeah, no, that's right. No, well, there's some variation there as well. The but I think that's terrific advice to people that want to write for a popular audience, that is to remember what excited you and never take anything for granted, because, you know, I'm always surprised and amazed about the things that my students don't know. But there's a good reason they don't know them, because they haven't studied them for 20-odd years.
Like exactly.
And I tend to forget this because I talk to academics a lot. But I think it's absolutely terrific advice, and I would suggest anybody follow it. So let me ask another related question, and that is, how did writing for a popular audience affect the way that you choose topics for books?
That, well, interestingly enough, the first few I did of the more popular books were all topics presented to me by the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And they said,
yeah,
could you do a book on Roman warfare? Would you do a book on the Punic Wars?
Yeah.
Could you do a book on the Roman army?
Yeah.
The first one where I'd actually chose the topic myself was the biography of Caesar, when I did before this last book.
Yeah.
And that was something I'd wanted to write for ages.
Uh-huh.
But by that time, I had an idea of how things worked, how publishers think.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, it's such an obvious topic. To be honest, I was glad, though, that I'd written several other things for popular market first, because I think I was better prepared to deal with something big like that.
Mm-hmm.
This latest book on the fall of the empire, again, came through, it was my idea, simply because I became interested in the subject and I wasn't really satisfied in everything else. But you have to think in terms of topics that have recognition.
Mm-hmm.
If you chose to write a biography of a Roman general like Domitius Corbulo or something, who might be frightfully interesting and is in many ways, but the name doesn't have recognition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody's heard of Julius Caesar. Everybody knows the Roman Empire fell.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have a topic where people are willing to pick the book up in the first place and flick through it in a bookshop and browse through it, and then they might read. So you have to think in terms of a market for something. So you don't quite have the freedom to look at the, you know, whatever your pet subject may be. The thing is, though, that plenty of the big subjects are absolutely fascinating. And if you were writing purely academic studies, you tend to be much more cautious about what you covered, because you think, well, I'm not going to take the risk of writing on such a big thing as that. I'll cover maybe one small aspect of Caesar's life, or I'll look at one bit of detail of the fall of the empire. It's rather like finding yourself often when you're teaching a course, and you quite often, with the nature of how academic jobs work, you'll end up teaching something that you haven't really studied in great detail yourself. And that can often be a lot of fun, where you read up on a subject and then find explaining that and passing that on, because, you know, we're all historians, so we know how to look at history. So in a way, it's a similar experience. And again, it's thinking in the same way you think of courses that would be useful, but also that students might like. You think in terms of, well, what's important, but also what would people find interesting? So you need to be, again, it's awareness of the audience, and it is a different audience to the purely academic one.
I think you should write a little article about this and submit it to I don't know whom, because all of your advice just seems terrific to me. I meet lots of people who want to write popular history, and especially not just popular history, but also historical fiction, and everything you've said I think is spot on. That is exactly right. The other thing I would say is, and I bet you agree with me, is that get a literary agent and listen to him or her. And really listen very carefully and follow their advices, because they do these things professionally, and they know what you should do better than at least I knew. I mean, I have an agent, not that I've ever made him any money, but but I do listen to him, and I'm probably not as closely as I should, or he'd be a lot richer. It's really important to listen to them. Go ahead.
Sorry, it's certainly true, because I did the first few books without an agent. I was simply, because I'd been offered the contract, and then the publishers liked the first coffee table book, so they asked me to do a succession of things, and it was with Caesar that I signed up with an agent, and she's just been superb.
Yeah.
And it's meant that I've been able to take more time to do each book, because obviously she's got a better deal.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
You have someone, as you say, that you can go to and say, well, you know, this is the idea. How does this work? What do you respond? Because they know the business,
yeah, they do.
And in the end, if you're doing this professionally, then you have to think of it as a business.
No, I think
you know, it isn't
right.
simply a hobby.
No, that's right. I think that's exactly right. And that's why you want to enlist somebody like a literary agent who will, in a sense, work as your agent, who will work for your benefit and will tell you what you need to do and what you have to do in order to make a living doing this. And, you know, I think if I tell all historians that I talk to that they should get literary agents, no matter how obscure their topics, because they have the skills that are necessary to do the research. They might not quite know how to write it, but the agent will help them with that. And, you know, you would be surprised, you know, some very obscure things, what you would think of as obscure things, can actually do quite well. I used to study the book industry a little bit when I was in journalism, and I worked on it, and I can tell you that there's a lot of demand out there for popular history. So I applaud you. I really do. I applaud you and envy you in a certain way. So let's talk about how Rome fell. You begin the book quite appropriately with the discussion of the historiography, which is enormous. I mean, this is the classic historical question. And it struck me in doing some research as background for this interview is that one of the problems with the question itself is that the number of reasons or causes or explanations that have been offered are almost too numerous, that your mind can't keep them all.
Yes, I mean, from the very beginning, I knew that it wouldn't be make any sense at all to write a book and to cover each one and each suggestion and then, you know, put the pros and cons for and against it, simply because of there are so many and they'll swamp you. But also, rather a lot of them do rely on very limited evidence.
Yes.
You know, I personally suspect that there were huge economic problems in the later centuries of the Roman Empire, and that was a major factor, whether it was a cause, whether it was to some extent an effect, but it would spiral out of hand. Measuring that is impossible because we don't have any statistics, not that we can use. And, you know, very sensible people have looked at exactly the same evidence and come to completely opposite conclusions. So there were things like that that I know are important and I talk about a little bit, but also realize that you simply cannot base an entire theory around that. And, of course, there are other reasons why there are other things I think have been neglected. But it's quite a daunting thing. Again, going back to what we said earlier, it's the sort of thing where if you were writing a formally academic study just for the scholars in the field, you'd have to turn it into some great multi-volume lifetime's work because there are just so many different things to take into account.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the sources themselves. And one of the things that you say in the book, or at very least imply, is that you really kind of have to go with what you have. And what we have, well, I'll let you talk about it. What do we have in terms of sources for this period, the late Roman period?
It's extremely patchy. You know, you have to remember that although there was an awful lot of history, an awful lot of literature, a lot of official documentation produced by the Roman Empire and in the ancient world, that the tiniest fraction of 1% of it has survived. You know, we have lost so much. Many things we're aware that they existed, but they haven't survived. There's plenty more out there that we simply don't know about. So you're dealing with a tiny glimpse of something that was far more substantial, far more like modern records. It's also in style presents all sorts of problems. The bulk of what we have for late antiquity tends to be religious and particularly Christian literature. Logically enough, that's what the monasteries preserve. You know, that's what was worth copying. And the reason stuff has survived is generally because somebody has considered it worthwhile to copy the manuscript and copy it again and again. You know, we rarely have an original document from 3rd century AD or something like that. It tends to be a medieval copy. That's likely to be the earliest manuscript source. So you have those problems of survival. You also have, even when you get to conventional history, you have the differences in style, which not only was ancient historiography a very different thing to the modern way of writing history, in that it tended to focus on certain things. There was much more emphasis on rhetoric, on style, on certain conventions, rather than necessarily getting to the truth or giving you the detail. But for large parts of the period covered in the book, there are not detailed, reliable narrative sources for basic events. So you even have question marks over the existence of certain emperors. One, for instance, who probably only lasted a few months and only ruled Britain and a few parts of northwest Europe in the 3rd century, his existence was confirmed because a coin turned up a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So he lived long enough to have coins minted in his name. And he's mentioned in the sources, but everyone had thought he was just an invention. To give you one idea of how poor sources get, particularly for the 3rd century AD, one of the main documents we have to use is a thing called the Historia Augusta. Now, this pretends to be a set of biographies of emperors written by 4 or 5 different authors in the early 4th century. Now, it's quite clearly, in fact, the work of one man, possibly to some extent as a joke or a satire, written much later. And yet we're so desperate that we end up using fragments of this because there simply is nothing else. And to get even the basic framework of events, you end up using all sorts of questionable stuff. So it's very refreshing when you get to the parts of the 4th century and you have a narrative like Ammianus Marcellinus, but only a small part of that actually survives. 6th century, you get Procopius with Justinian. But again, you know, before you get, even when you get to these, even when you get these good sources, they've got all the inherent biases, all the deliberate distortions, all the axes to grind of any source of any period. It's just that very rarely is there anything to check them against. So although we can say, well, we're pretty suspicious about this, we're not quite sure whether he's telling the truth or exaggerating, or whether it's he's just such a hostile commentator or he didn't even know, if we reject that, there isn't usually anything else to put in its place. And sometimes it's easy, you know, when you get wild stories about the Huns that Ammianus tells us about how, you know, they used to cook meat by putting it beneath their saddles, and as they rode along, the frictions sort of gradually cooked it and all this sort of. There's a lot that is deeply suspicious. But when he tells us about an emperor or his motives or the actions he actually carried out, as I say, if we reject it, there isn't a lot to put in its place. So all the time you have to keep putting in caveats. You have to have an element of caution that at times we simply cannot be sure what actually happened. So in some ways it means that makes it almost easier covering a wider period because, you know, it's that much harder to look at the detail. But it means that you could end up with almost every sentence, with almost any statement in the book, putting paragraph after paragraph of explanation, of justification, of doubts, of suspicion, of, well, you know, to the point where you'd laden it down so much that it would just become impossible to read, but also confusing. So you really have to begin at right from the word go and say, well, look, there's a lot we can't know, there's a lot we're not sure about. And even when you come to harder evidence like archaeology, which is something that has obviously grown massively since Gibbon wrote his classic Decline and Fall in the 18th century, often if you look at the archaeological record for one region, the impression of that period is based on a handful of sites that may not have been fully excavated or may have been excavated decades ago and not particularly scientifically or before modern methods were available, may have been interpreted on the basis of all sorts of assumptions that perhaps don't really stack up when you look at them in detail. And that because you're dealing again with a tiny sample of the evidence that's there, because that's all we've discovered so far, one or two new finds, one or two new sites might completely revolutionize the impression of what life was like in Spain or something in the 5th century. So that in particular, that's an ongoing thing. There will be new discoveries. There will be new interpretations.
No, I mean, I think it's an important lesson. I mean, we tend to think in this information-rich age that there should be good records for everything. But I'm reminded of a kind of a similar example in my own field, which was early modern Russian studies, where the documentary complex is quite similar, I think, to the one that you deal with. I have a colleague who had spent thousands and thousands of hours and much of his scholarly career trying to figure out how many wives Ivan the Terrible had. We just really don't know. And you know, you would think that would be dead simple. He had 5. He had 4. And these were their names. But we don't know. We really can't quite figure it out. And this guy has spent, you know, tons of time trying to figure it out. So in any event, I certainly can respect the fact that the documentary complex is quite limited. But nonetheless, we have to tell the tale. This is what I tell all my graduate students. You go with what you have, and this is what we have. So let me ask you a historiographical question now, because there's some discussion of this in the book, and I wasn't really aware of this, not being a classicist myself. We don't really quite know what to call this period. Is it now the fashion to call it the late antiquity, or what? Or is it the period of decline? What do we call it, and why do people not really know what to call it?
Well, decline and fall is very definitely out of fashion. It really has become late antiquity for most people, and some of this has to do with people sensibly saying that, you know, this is quite an interesting period. It should be treated separately. It should be treated on its own merits. It shouldn't. The old-fashioned way, the sort of 19th century, early 20th century way of looking at it was to see it very much as rather a poor thing compared mm-hmm. to earlier Greek and Roman history.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an element of sort of justifying themselves amongst the scholars working on it, particularly in English-speaking countries. So late antiquity developed. You also, I mean, running along at the same time, the Dark Ages has rather vanished from history, mm-hmm. and you now have the early medieval period
right.
because medieval history departments tend to be better funded and a bit more prestigious. So being an early medievalist makes a lot more sense career-wise.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you somebody else to talk to. So that, and yes, it is true that, you know, the Dark Ages aren't completely dark. There are lots of sources, you know, and we ought to be making the best of them, and they're an interesting period. But sometimes, again, you get this sense of almost people justifying their careers when mm-hmm. they really shouldn't need to. But there's that sense of, well, perhaps I've got to explain this.
Mm-hmm.
So for some people, it's still the late Roman Empire. Otherwise, it's late antiquity. Others will roll it into the early medieval world, particularly people who like the whole idea of sort of transformation, of this sort of seamless development into the Middle Ages, and isn't that all great?
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll get some quite odd divisions of period.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now quite possible, whereas a generation or so ago, anybody who was a specialist in this period would also have studied the early Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
It's now quite possible to go through your career and simply study one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
I will freely admit that I'm quite a latecomer to looking at this period. Pretty much everything I did as a student, my research as a graduate student, was all on the late Republic, the early Empire,
mm-hmm.
the period I've tended to write about in the past. I hope that's an advantage, that it gives you some perspective when you come in and look at the literature of the specialists
mm-hmm.
On this period, which is vast, and a lot of it is really mm-hmm. terrific. I mean, there have been huge advances in the field in the last 20, 30 years, and people have used sources a lot more intelligently. But on the other hand, some of the answers they've come up with just do not make any sense at all to me as an outsider. And mm-hmm. at the very least, if I can highlight those, I'd quite like somebody to, even if they can prove me wrong, just to address some of these issues, because they simply seem to be ignored.
I think that one of the most interesting things about the book is that, the people listening to this show will know, but historians tend to look for the causes of things. First, they look back a little bit, and then they, in competition with one another, push it back a little further,
mm-hmm.
and then they push it back a little further, and then it turns out mm-hmm. that everything is a result of something that happened in the 3rd century. Right? So, and this tendency to push things farther back, I think you also see in your field. And one of the things that I read it in the book, or maybe I'm just drawing an inference, is that people tend to look at what happened in the 5th century in the light of things that happened in the 3rd century during the 3rd century crisis. But I think your thesis is that actually, while there was a 3rd century crisis, that the empire was relatively strong in this period. Maybe you could talk a little about that.
Yes. I mean, I in many ways, it's the sort of the new orthodoxy of the specialists in the period is that Rome goes through a slightly wobbly phase in the 3rd century, but
mm-hmm.
the 4th century empire is this terrific, marvelously efficient thing that in many ways is superior
mm-hmm.
to the early empire. Now, personally, I don't buy that. It doesn't work. As soon as you look closely at how the empire actually trying to do anything,
mm-hmm.
it seems far more difficult to achieve quite simple tasks. However, the key thing to remember, which I try to emphasize throughout the book, is the sheer size of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is existing in a world where it does not face a serious competitor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's even true well into the 4th century and 5th and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
there is no one out there with whom the Romans are in meaningful contact. I mean, they're sort of dimly aware that China exists, and the Chinese are dimly aware the Romans exist, and there's some very sort of distant luxury trade, but there's no real meaningful contact. They're certainly not competitors. Mm-hmm. They're just too far away. Otherwise, Rome is bigger than everyone else. It's got more people. It's more sophisticated technologically. It's wealthier. Its economy is more sophisticated. Its military, everything is massively superior.
Mm-hmm.
There is no one out there who can compete on an even pitch, on a level playing field,
mm-hmm.
to Romans.
Mm-hmm.
So the sheer size of the Roman Empire means that it doesn't have to be efficient, and that mm-hmm. even in the later periods, even in the 3rd century and the 4th century, it is just bigger than everyone else. There is no one capable of pushing it over. There is no one really capable of destroying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this puts the question in a kind of a different light than, say, Gibbon did. I mean, in the sense that, the Romans seem to have snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory. In other words, the real question is, why, given all their superiority, how was it the case that they fell?
Well, that's the big question of the book, and the main answer that I think just shines out and has been ignored again and again by scholars. I don't really understand why the period specialists seem to ignore it, is that the system rots from the inside and it rots from the top.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the last few centuries, from 217 AD, right through to near the end of the 5th century, when the Western Empire collapses altogether and just becomes a memory, there are only about 3 decades without a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
So that's for more than 2.5 centuries, the mm-hmm. Romans are busily fighting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And because this doesn't have major cultural implications, you know, nothing much changes other than who's actually in charge when a civil war is fought, when it's decided, the specialists tend to take this as sort of part of the scenery. It's just a particularly mm-hmm. robust way of selecting the next emperor.
Mm-hmm.
But very few emperors get to die a natural death.
Mm-hmm.
More Roman soldiers are probably killed fighting other Roman soldiers than they are fighting foreign enemies.
Mm-hmm.
These wars tend to be fought inevitably inside the empire. So when a city is stormed, when it's sacked, when it's destroyed, when cattle are driven off to feed the troops, when areas are plundered, all of that is happening within your own empire, within your own provinces.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes on, and it fundamentally affects the mindset of the people in charge. The emperors themselves obviously are far more concerned about internal rivals, because they're the people who will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the king of Persia, some German chieftain, however many battles they win against you, they are very unlikely to catch or to kill you. They're not going to take your job. Mm-hmm. But another Roman has to get rid of you,
mm-hmm.
another challenger, another usurper. He is your very personal enemy,
mm-hmm.
and the civil war can only end when one of you is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this sense whereby emperors become concerned about survival, but so does everybody else at each level in the bureaucracy,
mm-hmm.
because your opponents, the challengers, will come from your generals, from your senior bureaucrats, from your governors. So you can't really trust them. The people you have to use to control the empire, because you can't be everywhere, you can't do everything, you cannot trust these people. And they know that the emperor is suspicious of them. And you have a situation where, as far as they're concerned, they have to be nervous about everybody else, both their equals, their seniors, their subordinates, because one of the best ways to prove your loyalty to the emperor is to rat on somebody else,
mm-hmm.
and to claim that they're plotting and condemn them.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with a situation where you can't trust anyone, and everybody at all levels is far more concerned with personal survival, personal success and enrichment than they are with actually doing the job well.
Mm-hmm.
And because the empire is so big, because its resources are so massive, it will probably win in the end. You know, even though the system is appallingly inefficient, it doesn't matter,
mm-hmm.
or at least it doesn't matter immediately. And what you have is it sort of lurches along, and there will be defeats, but they're not going to be too bad. Most of your enemies, they can raid into the empire, they can invade, but they can't stay there. They can't really conquer until much later.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, you've got more resources, you can send more soldiers, you can bribe them to go away, you can win the conflict,
mm-hmm.
or at least you won't lose too badly.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the luxury. You can keep on fighting civil wars, and the empire doesn't collapse.
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes less and less capable of dealing with even quite small-scale problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then you end up by the late 4th and 5th century where you will have these sudden, very dramatic failures where you will have military disasters, you'll lose a war, or you might lose a province. And you've got to the point where the system is creaking so badly that when it does face even quite a small crisis, it simply cannot cope in a way that was unimaginable centuries earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yet you've still got all the resources. You are still so big. You are so sophisticated, but you can't use them in an effective way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, to someone who has studied Russian history for over 20 years, this sounds like the story of the Soviet Union to me, but we can come back to that in a second. Everything you just said about the Romans could have been said about the Soviet Union, I guarantee you. But let me ask this question. Why was it that the Romans were smart people? Why was it the case that they failed to produce a stable system of succession to high office that did not involve assassination as one of its primary tools?
Well, the thing is, they'd had it for a while. I mean, if you look, it was one of the interesting things coming from doing the biography of Caesar onto this next project, in that Caesar's life was dominated by civil war. You know, there's rioting in the Forum months after he's born. When he's a teenager, the first Roman, well, for the first time, Roman army is actually led by its commander against the city of Rome and storms Rome, and that will happen time and again. So the first century BC is dominated by civil war, by attempted coups, by assassinations, which culminates in Caesar's adopted son, Octavian, become the Emperor Augustus, is the last man left standing.
Mm-hmm.
And he creates the imperial system, the principate, as we call it, because he pretended to be the princeps, the first among equals, the first citizen, rather than the military dictator that he, in fact, was.
Mm-hmm.
But then for more than 200 years, there are only very, very brief interruptions to the stability. I mean, a few emperors get assassinated, usually because they're mad, and, you know, after a while people get fed up even of that. But there are not these repeated civil wars. There is far more stability. So, you know, unless you take the view that that's almost a fluke, then the system has developed where it actually works quite well. It works particularly well in the second century where, almost by chance, you end up with several emperors who don't have sons of their own.
Mm-hmm.
So they adopt somebody as their successor, and that means they've got far more choice over who they get and how much talent they've got. But you also have a fundamental shift that happens after Marcus Aurelius, who does have a son, and he's succeeded by his son Commodus, who proves to be one of the certainly bad and possibly mad emperors. But who, you know, last 12 years before he's finally strangled in his bath. That succession then leads to war. His death leads to a civil war because there's no... And after that, you're getting very quickly into this cycle that will not really end till the empire goes. But,
and why at that moment? Why do you think the system sort of slipped over an edge or reached a kind of tipping point where you had this cycle of civil wars, particularly then?
Part of the problem is that when Commodus is initially succeeded by a chap called Pertinax, who gets murdered after 3 months. But then you have a four-year civil war when three commanders of the biggest armies in the empire fight it out, and they do deals with each other for a while to sort of, you know, let's share things. Then they basically kill each other off. That the dynasty that succeeds to that starts to make some fairly fundamental changes to the system, which will continue throughout the third century. Up until then, anyone who could possibly be considered an emperor had to be not just a senator, but one of a very small number of important leading senators, you know, maybe a dozen or so men in the entire empire who could be considered potential emperors. That does make it a lot easier for the emperor to keep an eye on these, you know, these people. He knows who the challengers are likely to be. And even a bad emperor can keep an eye on them, but a good emperor will placate these people, give them enough honors, or also, you know, watch them and if necessary, execute them. Then it changes. The emperors who succeed, the ones who win through civil war, are obviously nervous of their position. And they have a tendency to marginalize the Senate. And this happens over about a generation, where instead of being the men through whom the emperor ruled the empire, you know, they provide all your most important governors, all your army commanders, all your advisors, and any emperor who moves beyond this group for his advisors is hated pretty quickly, and most simply don't do this. Instead, you start choosing advisors from the next social class down, which is a far bigger group, the equestrian order, that numbers in probably tens of thousands instead of a few hundred. And as you make these people your army commanders, as you make them your advisors, they get power.
Mm-hmm.
You end up with a situation where in 217, when the Emperor Caracalla is murdered, the commander of his bodyguard, who isn't a senator, who's had no political career whatsoever, but because he controls the troops on the spot, declares himself emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, it becomes much rarer for a senator to be an emperor. And the senators stop having a military role. They stop being the governors. You end up dividing power. Emperors try to make themselves safe by relying on people of a lower social status to be their most important agents, their commanders, their governors. But that doesn't work, because then these people become emperor, and there are a lot more of them, and it's much, much harder to watch thousands of potential rivals than it is a dozen or so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very difficult. The emperor can be made in Spain, he can be made in Britain or Syria. Anywhere where you can get enough troops to proclaim you emperor, then you have a reasonable chance. You can be a challenger. You might not last very long, but you could succeed.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing becomes less stable, and it is a key mistake. The emperors think they're making themselves safer, but in fact, they make their position far more precarious. It's the same later on, at the end of the 3rd century, when ritual develops at court to a far more extreme degree. You know, Augustus pretended to be the first among equals. He would walk through the streets of Rome. He would rise to greet senators when they came into his house, and he would shake hands with them. By the end of the 3rd century, you have emperors like Diocletian who are wearing jeweled robes, who insist that people must prostrate themselves on the ground when they come into the imperial presence. You know, the favored ones might get to kiss the hem of your robe. You're surrounding yourself with ritual. You make it much harder for people to get to you. In theory, because this should make the emperor more majestic, it should make him less vulnerable to assassination, to attacks like that. But in reality, it isolates him.
Mm-hmm.
And it also means that, again, once you become emperor, all of these things are now, you know, you're treated that way. That's how people behave to you. So, again, it doesn't really matter who you are. All you need is just enough backing.
Yeah, no, I see that. So I find that, you know, I find the explanation quite compelling, again, because it jives with everything that I know about Soviet history, so I've seen this before.
Well, in the end, the military dictatorship is probably going to go the same way.
Yeah, no, right. So let me just present a couple of other things that have been major explanations that have been proffered for the decline of the empire. You've dealt with one of them, but I might like you talking about them a little bit more, and that is the Germanic invasions and the Persians. How did they contribute to the decline of the empire and its fall?
Well, the sort of the orthodox view is that the Persians are this new superpower that suddenly springs to life in the early 3rd century, and because it's such a threat, then Rome has to militarize. Rome has to become far more of a blatant dictatorship, and it has to reform, and the emperor has to be much more ruthless about the way he uses and controls power. I don't think that, again, that works, because the Persians, they are aggressive at the start, but that's because the Persian king has made himself king through his own civil war, through rebelling against the Parthians, and he needs to be aggressive. But Persian aggression tends to come in the aftermath of a Roman civil war.
Mm-hmm.
When the Romans are busy stripping their garrisons away from the frontiers and going and clobbering living daylights out of each other, they're vulnerable. And the Persians, you know, they're a new regime. They need glory. They need money. The big bad Romans are your neighbors. Everybody hates them. So it's a very good, glorious thing to go and raid the Roman provinces, mm-hmm. bring back a lot of slaves, bring back a lot of plunder. So Persian attacks tend to occur and be far more successful whenever the Romans make themselves weak.
Mm-hmm.
I find it actually difficult to believe that they are much stronger or more threatening than the Parthians. They are still a big civilization. They're organized. They have an organized army. But they're a lot smaller than Rome.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the population. They don't have the money. You know, there was never going to be a case of a Persian army arriving on the River Tiber and sacking Rome itself.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the Romans pushed down the Euphrates and Tigris valleys time after time and burned down the Persian capitals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a different – they are powerful. They're the biggest state out there, but they are still dwarfed by Roman power
mm-hmm.
until the empire divides, and by the time you get to about the 6th century, then maybe there's equality. But it's taken Rome to decline a huge degree before that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans, the tribes, the barbarians are a slightly different problem in that again, there's the old view that these unite, you know, that whereas you had, say, in Julius Caesar's day, lots of small independent tribes, that they coalesce into these great confederations like the Franks and the Alemanni and the Goths and, you know, groups that will carve out kingdoms for themselves in as the Roman Empire collapses. Again, there's a problem in that is when you actually look at how these tribes behave militarily and politically, there seems no difference at all between the 1st century BC and the 4th century AD. But, you know, they act in exactly the same way. They don't seem to have bigger armies. They don't seem to have huge numbers of people. If anything, the armies are probably smaller. And once again, just like the Persians, German successes, barbarian raids occur most often at a time when the Romans are busy fighting each other.
Mm-hmm.
And in the aftermath of successive civil wars where the Roman army has simply worn itself out, it isn't there, it isn't in place, even if soldiers exist, they're not well trained, they're not well supported, they're not well controlled, they're not that confident. So it's one of those things where the Germans get more and more successful because Rome is weak. And by the time they are creating kingdoms, by the time the Visigoths can overrun Spain, the Vandals can take Africa, the Goths later on Italy, there are not very many of them in these armies.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that there is virtually no one who can organize a big enough force to oppose them.
Mm-hmm.
There's another interesting side, which again, we tend to think very much of these sort of ravening hordes of barbarians streaming across the frozen River Rhine and all this sort of thing. But much of the contact between the empire and the barbarians is peaceful, and it's to do with trade.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's something where Rome's own problems cause the tribes outside, who have always been aggressive but haven't been that organized, but they tend to make them more aggressive because the people you really trade with are the communities based around the Roman army along the frontiers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when those march away to fight a civil war and often don't come back, the market for the German farmers has gone.
Mm-hmm.
So the livelihood these people have relied on has suddenly vanished, which means that to feed your family, to feed yourself, probably the best thing to do is to go and raid the Roman province because, hey, the soldiers have gone, so the opportunity's there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that when a civil war occurs, for a Roman leader, he knows he's going to be fighting another Roman army.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't have a technological or tactical advantage over the enemy, which means that in the end, it's numbers that will probably count.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't raise lots of disciplined Roman soldiers quickly and form them into an army. But what you can do is go and hire a load of barbarians, pay them to come and fight on your side,
mm-hmm.
which is good. But given that somebody is bound to lose the civil war, that means all the mercenaries they've hired are then stuck in the middle of the empire somewhere, probably not too welcomed by the opponent,
mm-hmm.
who isn't likely to want to pay them. So you end up with some of the raids starting from German mercenaries who've got to get their way, find their way home.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you create lots of German war leaders because mm-hmm. you keep paying them subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
And when these people don't have a Roman to hire them, they've got to feed their warriors. They've got to pay and reward them. So again, the best alternative is to go and raid the Roman provinces, get glory that way.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it, again, this Roman instability feeds outwards, and it encourages and makes more aggressive the peoples outside at the same time as you're making yourself very, very vulnerable to attack.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. I can absolutely understand that dependence. And then once the Romans withdraw, then there's a certain amount of hard feeling about that. So let's turn then to an unavoidable name here in the discussion of Roman affairs, that is Gibbon. Gibbon's favorite explanations, as I recall them, from about 20 years ago. and that would be the decline of morals or civic virtue. Is there anything to this?
There's an element. It's certainly the Romans, as indeed the Greeks, tended to explain any big problem essentially in moral terms.
Yeah.
So we're not as good men as our fathers were, our grandfathers were, and therefore we don't fight as well. We bicker with each other. Ambition, greed, all these things take over. They were saying exactly the same things in the 1st century BC when they're having the civil wars there as they do in the 4th, 5th, and later.
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly, it's one of the things that, again, some of the scholars working on the period will dispute this, but the archaeology is difficult to argue with. Roman cities tend to be bigger, more prosperous in the 2nd and early 3rd century,
mm-hmm.
and they shrink in size. You don't get the big monuments built that you had after that. There is also something of a withdrawal from public life, but it is limited. The biggest group you lose are the senators,
mm-hmm.
because the emperor doesn't trust them, so they can't have their political careers. Now, in some ways you think, well, that just cuts off the sort of top 600 or so people who then basically will concentrate on literary pursuits and on honor and prestige at court, but not really having major responsibility, and on doing favors for each other and this sort of thing. But the local aristocracies, the people who were the big men in a city in Spain, say, or North Africa, the people who do well locally earlier on aspired to make their children equestrians and then perhaps their grandchildren senators. You know, by the 2nd century AD, you've got men like Trajan and Hadrian, whose families were from Spain. You'll have Septimius Severus from Africa. You're having emperors, not just senators, but emperors who have really had a long family history in one of the provinces.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they are Roman, they aspire to going to the center.
Mm-hmm.
That weakens as cities become less important, as the central government takes more and more power into its own hands, and instead of letting the cities and the provinces govern themselves as much as possible on the day-to-day basis, then central government wants to control it.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't really big enough, and it isn't really capable enough of doing this terribly well. But it means that being an imperial civil servant has far more advantages than getting involved in your local politics,
mm-hmm.
to the extent where you're actually having to force people to take on obligations, because people in local government spent a lot of their own money in building projects in the cities. You know, they didn't get much of a salary. If they wanted to be famous, which was the, you know, the great urge to excel, to exalt your family name, you had to spend, you had to commit a lot. That amount is no longer important. You get a job in the imperial civil service, you get status, you get honors, you get legal protection, and you get exemptions from doing anything from your home community.
Mm-hmm.
There is definitely a rotting of the system. Again, I suspect it has far more to do with this, the immediate political problems that you have at the very center of the empire, and it gradually filters down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see what you mean. So another and related factor that Gibbon talks about famously is Christianity. Is there anything to that?
To some extent, I mean, people do tend to exaggerate the extent to which Gibbon argues that this was a major factor in decline. He certainly is extremely scathing, and often, you know, this is sometimes where his wit is most frequently and well expressed, is having a go at some of the leaders of the early church and some of the bishops who were busy organizing schisms. And but you have to remember as well, you know, he's an 18th century Englishman who's writing in the Enlightenment and who is not terribly keen on the Catholic Church and a Pope in Rome,
mm-hmm.
particularly as, you know, almost as an act of student rebellion, Gibbon himself had briefly converted to Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an element of personal history as well. And, you know, you've only got to go back when he was a small child, you've got the last Jacobite rising in Scotland with, you know, a Catholic king.
Yeah.
So it's very much a live issue, and there's this suspicion of particularly an organized Catholic Church. It's obviously one of the great stories of the period of how Christianity goes from being this persecuted sect in the first and second centuries to becoming the religion of empire under Constantine and afterwards. And, you know, really by the end of the period, there is very little trace left of paganism, certainly in the higher levels of society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge story, but when you look closely, there's actually very little difference in behavior between the Christian empire and the pagan empire. The ideology of power, the ideology of empire doesn't really change at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Constantine converts largely because he becomes convinced that the Christian God will give him victory.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the power of God rather than a deep emotional thing or conviction. That perhaps comes later. But previous emperors had claimed to be particularly favored by certain divinities, especially the sun god in the 3rd century,
mm-hmm.
and had tried to promote this. There was a sort of move towards aspects that were similar, so that it makes a difference. But, I mean, Gibbon obviously has a go at the rise of monasticism and how many influential people and important people stepped out of public life and went off and became hermits or nuns or whatever. You can easily exaggerate that.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to remember what we said at the beginning, that our sources are limited, and an awful lot of what survives tends to be stuff that the church considered important. So we get lots of lives of ascetics, of hermits, of, you know, Stylites, these chaps who sat on top of poles contemplating. they weren't normal, you know, even at the time. That's why people wrote about them. And I don't mean that in a sort of, you know, critical sense. You take that, but in terms of, you know, this was not what everybody was doing. You tell these stories in the same way, you know, we do a horror movie or something like that, because it's exceptional, because it's exciting. That's what people want to hear, mm-hmm. and that's what they might admire. But it isn't, you know, this isn't everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
For the overwhelming majority. So it's a lot more limited. And again, it's something really that follows on later rather than causes the problems of the empire. People withdraw from politics because politics has just got so dangerous and public life has got so dangerous that it can simply be safer to go into the church. I mean, it's quite interesting that in some of the later civil wars, when you beat somebody who really, you know, the emperor decides he just isn't worth killing, so he isn't that much of a threat, you often make that defeated rival a bishop to send him off somewhere to go and, you know, just keep, you know, I don't need to kill you, but just busy yourself that way and don't worry about politics anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I see. No, I'm reminded of something that some very wise person said to me, and that is that if all that you had was a dictionary of national biographies surviving from some era, you would come to the conclusion that everyone was famous then. So yeah, you do have to. People don't write about everything. They only write what's interesting to them. So let me ask you a kind of controversial question. I'm very interested in this myself. We've skirted it a little bit here, and that is, you close the book with some discussion of attempts to compare the. I'm not going to call it the modern American empire, because I don't think it's an empire. The modern United States with the late Roman Empire. Maybe you could talk. You're not a big fan of this, I think, and maybe you could talk a little bit about why not.
There are quite a few reasons, and I think on the whole, you know, we all ought to be very glad that the modern America isn't like ancient Rome, because you really wouldn't, I mean, much as I admire and like studying them, you really wouldn't want the Romans around in the world. But it is something that you just find again and again, this parallel is brought up. From the beginning, I wanted to write the book as a historian looking at the period. I think if you start with an assumption and you want to prove a case for similarity with the modern world, you will find it.
Mm-hmm.
You will have whatever prejudices, whatever beliefs you have, you will see them in the evidence because you'll want to see them.
Mm-hmm.
And really you need to look at the evidence and see what pattern emerges on its own and try and understand the fall of Rome simply within the context of the times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as possible, we try to make ourselves detached. I know it's you cannot completely remove all biases, all assumptions, but as a historian, you know, you're trying to understand the past on its own terms. And I think if ever you stray away from that consciously, then you're going to go down the wrong path, and it will weaken everything you say. I mean, the Romans, of course, in some ways that there are things that are useful. In that, you know, for the Romans, their word imperium means power.
Mm-hmm.
So from their point of view, you could see the United States as an empire because it is a power. But it isn't the same, with obviously the exception of the physical occupation of the West and the American continent. You know, it has never been the sort of power that has sought major overseas provinces and possessions, which is the one thing that the Romans did on a very big scale.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of basic differences in just the world has changed so much in terms of the sheer size of the population, the speed of communications, the pace of everything, and a lot of assumptions of international law, ideas of this sort, which, okay, may be to some extent ephemeral, but the Romans didn't really recognize the right of anybody else to exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they never dealt with people as an equal.
Mm-hmm.
They simply thought in terms of their own advantage. They thought it quite natural that other people would fight for their freedom, but they also had no compunction at all about taking it away from them and turning them into Romans.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you try and look at specifics, if you try and force the modern world into the mold of ancient Rome, then in the end, you're not really going to learn very much, and you're not going to understand the modern world properly.
Mm-hmm.
I think the value of history is that it tells us about how people act and how they think and how they work. And whilst, yes, a society will affect an awful lot of things of how we behave, how we act, in the end, personally, I believe that people are fundamentally the same as they always have been, and that the way they interact, the way the societies work, will always tend to fit into similar patterns.
Mm-hmm.
There are general lessons I think we can learn about how a political system can fail, can collapse, can decline. There are also sheer warnings in that again, going back to an earlier point, the basic truth of the Roman Empire was that it was so huge, it was so wealthy, it was so sophisticated, far more so than any rival, that it didn't face serious competition. And it meant that it could survive for a very long time without being efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that is a warning to all of us, and that's a warning to businesses as much to countries, to any institution, in that it's easy to take for granted that because you keep on being successful, you must deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps it's a particular warning we ought to think about in modern Western democracies, is that it's easy for us to take all these things for granted. And they're pretty rare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there haven't been too many societies like those in history.
Mm-hmm.
And these things can be fragile. These systems can collapse as the Roman Republic collapsed. The Roman, you know, even when you are powerful, even when you dominate the world, that
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that you always will if
mm-hmm.
you stop working for it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if you stop, in the end, realizing what you're there for
mm-hmm.
and remembering that. And, you know, whether it's a business competing and effectively marketing, effectively producing, doing all these things, if it doesn't face serious competition, its weaknesses, its flaws will not become obvious
mm-hmm.
until suddenly the situation changes, the circumstances become less favorable, or a competitor arrives,
mm-hmm.
and then you tend to get hit very strongly
mm-hmm.
and you collapse quickly. With countries, the same thing can happen. You know, it's obviously recently everyone and their dog seems to be talking about the Great Depression and assuming that, you know,
mm-hmm.
we're going into the new one, all this sort of thing, in the same way that you had a lot of talk in the run-up to the Iraq War about the 30s and the appeasement of Hitler and
mm-hmm.
Neither of which situation, I mean, I'm not arguing at all either way about any of those things, are exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the threat of international terrorism, which is a serious and a dreadful thing, is not the same as the threat of Nazi Germany
mm-hmm.
or Imperial Japan,
mm-hmm.
because those were organized, industrial, powerful states that do things differently
mm-hmm.
and have the capacity to inflict far more damage. So sometimes I think we end up, you know, we like to, in the same way that the modern crisis could become another Great Depression, well, it's difficult to see as yet, and I hope we won't see it, the soup kitchens, the levels of poverty
mm-hmm.
that you had in the 30s
mm-hmm.
being repeated, because we've got a lot further to fall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are a far more prosperous society to start off with.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes, you know, history gets used very casually.
Mm-hmm.
And again, everything, every immediate disaster, every short-term disaster can be the collapse of the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Romans were talking about their empire collapsing for centuries before it actually did. And yet, even at the very end, no one could quite imagine it happening. You know,
yeah.
you talked about it, but it was one of those things you take it for granted. So I think there are sort of lessons in there, and I think there are things we can learn, but they're more very general things about human behavior.
Yeah. I think that's just a terrific statement, general statement of how you should and should not use historical analogies, and I agree with absolutely everything in it. I think I'm going to get a T-shirt that says, I think your expression was, history gets used very casually. And I'm going to wear that now because that is exactly right. I mean, people just glom onto these things and they sort of mold them around contemporary events as if they were identical, when in fact they're really very, very, very different. And you know, it's a curious thing, and it's something that professional historians and popular historians have to fight against, you know, all the time, because these things, you know, they get repeated and they kind of get into the cultural stream, and they're very difficult to remove, especially, you know, I was just talking to students about appeasement. Appeasement is something we don't seem to be able to do away with. And really it's achieved a kind of life of its own. The idea itself has an autonomy that isn't rooted in what happened in the late 1930s. It's now an entity that exists and has to be fought on its own. So it's very, very peculiar. So anyway, let me say that we've taken up a lot of your time, and I really, really appreciate it. Let me ask you our traditional final question here on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
I'm going back to really the sort of logical follow-up to Caesar, in that I'm sticking with Shakespeare as regards titles, and I'm doing a paired biography of Antony and Cleopatra.
Oh, really?
So it's a slightly different thing. It's an interesting story because Cleopatra in particular, I think people always get wrong. And the more I look at it, the more I think the image of Mark Antony, which really developed quite soon, almost some of it in his own lifetime, and some of it his deliberate presentation himself as this sort of bluff military man.
Mm-hmm.
When you look closely, isn't borne out by the facts. That wasn't what he was. He was far more of a politician. He actually spent next to no time fighting anybody or with the Roman army.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the other thing is, the uncomfortable truth is that we like an Egyptian Cleopatra.
Mm-hmm.
But she was actually born and lived closer in time to us than she did to the builders of the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, no, that's right. That is absolutely right. Actually, I'm forgetting exactly who it was, but I did interview somebody who wrote a biography of Cleopatra on this show. In fact, I'm going to take just a second to look it up, even, because I feel embarrassed that I cannot remember her name. I will say it in the – darn it, I cannot remember. Well, I encourage anybody who has access to New Books in History to go look, but she wrote a terrific book about Cleopatra, and she points just this out. The other thing is that, yeah, the Egyptian Cleopatra – it's very interesting about Cleopatra because she really lived in the Hellenistic world. She wasn't, she wasn't very Egyptian at all. One question I actually asked her – darn if I can remember her name – was what language the two of them, Mark Antony and Cleopatra, spoke to each other in. I guess it must have been Greek, right?
As far as we know, she didn't speak
In Greek, right. So I thought it was an interesting point. But anyway, we look very much forward to seeing that book. Good luck delivering it. You told me to deliver it by Christmas.
Yep.
That sounds like a lot of work.
I'm
sure that you'll bring it off wonderfully. So we've been interviewing, we've been talking to Adrian Goldsworthy today about his terrific new book, How Rome Fell, The Death of a Superpower. I've enjoyed the interview very much. And I'd like to say thank you, Adrian, for being on the show.
Thanks, Marshall. It's been great to have to be here.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Adrian Goldsworthy about his new book, How Rome Fell, Death of a Superpower. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.
Lines Inscribed Upon a Cup Formed from a Skull by George Gordon, Lord Byron. Read for LibriVox.org by Sean Craig Smith. For more information, or to volunteer, go to www.LibriVox.org. Start not, nor deem my spirit fled. In me behold the only skull from which, unlike a living head, whatever flows is never dull. I lived, I loved, I quaffed like thee. I died. Let earth my bones resign. Fill up. Thou canst not injure me. The worm hath fouler lips than thine. Better to hold the sparkling grape than nurse the earthworm's slimy brood, and circle in the goblet's shape the drink of gods than reptiles' food. Where once my wit perchance hath shone, in aid of others let me shine, and when, alas, our brains are gone, what nobler substitute than wine? Quaff while thou canst another race, when thou and thine, like me, are sped, may rescue thee from earth's embrace, and rhyme and revel with the dead. Why not, since through life's little day our heads such sad effects produce, redeemed from worms and wasting clay? This chance is theirs to be of use. End of poem. This recording is in the public domain.
There's a Certain Slant of Light by Emily Dickinson, read for LibriVox.org by Kim Stish. There's a certain slant of light on winter afternoons that oppresses like the weight of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us, we can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None may teach it anything, 'tis the seal, despair. An imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens. Shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. End of poem. This recording is in the public domain.
The Garden of Love by William Blake. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Caroline Schumacher. The Garden of Love by William Blake. I went to the Garden of Love, and saw what I never had seen. A chapel was built in the midst, where I used to play on the green. And the gates of this chapel were shut, and thou shalt not writ over the door. So I turned to the Garden of Love, that many sweet bowers bore, and I saw it was filled with graves, and tombstones where flowers should be, and priests in black gowns were walking their rounds, and binding with briars my joys and desires. End of recording. This recording is in the public domain.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Best of Bernie Sanders, High Points from His Senate Filibuster. Today, we must break up the largest banks.
While we bailed out Wall Street because they were quote-unquote too big to fail, three out of the four largest financial institutions, all of whom were bailed out very significantly, are now larger today than they were before the bailout. Incredibly, Wells Fargo has grown 43% bigger, J.P. Morgan Chase has grown 51% bigger, and Bank of America is now 138% larger than before the financial crisis began.
This appeal was part of Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders' 8.5-hour filibuster speech in protest of the bill that, among other gifts, extended tax breaks to the richest Americans. And Sanders is not at all the only one who demands the breakup of the banks. Among the many conservatives, whose quotes you will hear in a moment, is Alan Greenspan, who also admits that he made a mistake by promoting deregulation when he headed the Federal Reserve. Senator Sanders began speaking on the morning of Friday, December 10, 2010, and held the floor until 7 p.m., His filibuster was carried on C-SPAN and crashed the Senate service. Here is Sanders laying out the urgent need to break up the banks.
The immediate cause of this crisis is, you know, just gets me sick thinking about it, and that is what the crooks on Wall Street have done to the American people. These people fought for a period of years to deregulate the banking industry. These people said to us, well, you know, if you just will do away with Glass-Steagall, if you will just allow financial institutions, commercial banks, investor banks, insurance companies, if you allow them to merge, do away with these walls, which Glass-Steagall since the Depression had established, my God, it will be just terrific. It'll be good for our economy, good for the American people, good for our international competitiveness. And I remember that, those debates, Mr. President, because I was at that point in the House of Representatives. I was on the committee that dealt with that. And I remember all of the times that Alan Greenspan came before the committee and said, you know, and Robert Rubin, you're Republicans, you're Democrats, coming before the committee and saying, oh, it's what you got to do. You got to deregulate. You got to let these guys merge. Bigger is better. And against my votes, I did not think deregulation was a good idea. I thought it would lead to disaster in some place in this world. There is a quote of mine which kind of pretty much predicts what was going to happen. But needless to say, I was one vote, and majority of the members in the House and Senate voted to deregulate. And the rest is, unfortunately, history. And what we saw is that people on Wall Street, I think, you know, I may be wrong on this, but I think operating from a business model based on fraud, based on dishonesty, understanding that the likelihood of them ever getting caught was small, that if things got really bad, they would be bailed out by the taxpayers, understanding that they are too powerful to be ever be put in jail, to be indicted, understanding that in this country, when you're a CEO on Wall Street, you have so much wealth and so much power and have so many lawyers and so many friends in Congress that you could do pretty much anything you want and not much is going to happen to you. And they did it. They did it. Their greed and their recklessness and their illegal behavior destroyed this economy. And what they did to the American people is so horrible, so horrible. So here you had a middle class which is already being battered, as we discussed, as a result of trade agreements, loss of manufacturing jobs, health care costs going up, can't afford to send your kid to college. That's going on for years. And then these guys start pushing worthless and complicated financial instruments. The whole thing explodes. The whole thing explodes. And they come crying to the taxpayers of America to bail them out. And I will never forget, never forget, Hank Paulson coming before the Democratic caucus saying that within a few days he needed $700 billion or the entire world financial system would collapse. And my suggestion to him at that meeting is, if you need the money, why don't you go to your friends and get the money? Why don't you go to all your banker friends and your millionaire friends and your billionaire friends and get some of that money, and don't go to the middle class of this country that has already been harmed? And in fact, we brought an amendment here to the floor of the Senate, and one of the first amendments that I brought as a senator, which would suggested that the top 2% should pay for the bailout, not the American people. It got defeated in a voice vote. So what goes on in Wall Street is that we have seen a tremendous concentration of ownership there. Another issue that we do not talk enough about. I know Senator Brown and Senator Kaufman and I worked on a proposal to try to break up these large financial institutions. I think we got 30-some-odd votes on that. Couldn't do it. So what the American people should know now is that while we bailed out Wall Street because they were, quote-unquote, too big to fail, three out of the four largest financial institutions, all of whom were bailed out very significantly, are now larger today than they were before the bailout. Incredibly, since the start of the financial crisis, Wells Fargo has grown 43% bigger, J.P. Morgan Chase has grown 51% bigger, and Bank of America is now 138% larger than before the financial crisis began. Can you imagine that? We bailed these guys out because they were too big to fail, and now three out of the four largest ones are much larger than they were. How did that happen? Well, in 2008, Bank of America, the largest commercial bank in this country, which received a $45 billion taxpayer bailout, purchased Countrywide, the largest mortgage lender in this country, and Merrill Lynch, the largest stock brokerage firm in the country. That's how Bank of America expanded. In 2008, J.P. Morgan Chase, which received a $25 billion bailout from the Bush Treasury Department and a $29 billion bridge loan from the Federal Reserve, acquired Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual, the largest savings and loan in the country. That's how J.P. Morgan Chase, a huge bank, became even bigger. In 2008, the Treasury Department provided an $18 billion tax break to Wells Fargo to purchase Wachovia, allowing that bank to control 11% of all bank deposits in this country. Hear this, Mr. President, because this is just quite unbelievable. When we try to understand what's going on in the economy today, the rich getting richer, poor getting poorer, middle class collapsing. Today, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, the four largest financial institutions in this country, hold about $7.4 trillion in assets, and that is equal to over half of the nation's estimated total output last year. Four financial institutions have assets worth more than 52% of our total output last year. And instead of breaking these folks up, these large institutions up, we let them get bigger. In fact, Mr. President, according to Simon Johnson, the former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, quote, as a result of the crisis and various government rescue efforts, the largest six banks in our economy now have total assets in excess, he claims, of 63% of GDP. This is a significant increase from even 2006, when the same bank's assets were around 55% of GDP. You understand what this is about? Four financial institutions owning over half of the assets of America. You talk about economic power. You talk about political power. That is what we were talking about. Simon Johnson continues. He said, this is a complete transformation compared with the situation in the United States just 15 years ago, when the largest six banks had combined assets of only about 17% of GDP. So today, 15 years ago, 17%, six banks. Today, four banks, he claims 63% of GDP. In other words, Mr. President, over the last 15 years, the largest banks in this country have more than tripled in size. Now, Mr. President, not only are too big to fail financial institutions bad for taxpayers, the enormous concentration of ownership in the financial sector has led to higher bank fees, usurious interest rates on credit cards, and fewer choices for consumers. What do you think happens when you have a few institutions, a handful of institutions, controlling mortgage lending or the ability of people, where people get their credit cards? Today, Mr. President, these huge financial institutions have become so big that, according to the Washington Post, the four largest banks in America now issue one out of every two mortgages, two out of three credit cards, and hold four out of every $10 in bank deposits in the entire country. Mr. President, if any of these financial institutions were to get into major trouble again, taxpayers would be on the hook for another substantial bailout, and we cannot allow that to happen. So the whole reason for the bailout is that if any of these financial institutions collapse, it would take down a significant part of the economy and millions of jobs. We had to prop them up. We had to bail them out. And it turns out that since we bailed them out, these handful of financial institutions are enjoying very strong profits, and they are paying their CEOs even more in compensation than they did before the breakdown. In my view, Mr. President, if we are serious about understanding why the middle class is collapsing, if we are serious about really getting this economy moving again, long term, we have got to have the courage to do exactly what Teddy Roosevelt did back in the trust-busting days and break these banks up. The point that Roosevelt was making is that it is bad for the economy when a handful of entities control industry after industry. They have a stranglehold on the economy. You got to break them up. The legislation that I introduced last year, S-2746, the Too Big to Fail, Too Big to Exist Act, would break up these large financial institutions. That legislation would require the Secretary of Treasury to identify every single financial institution and insurance company in this country that is too big to fail within 90 days, and after 1 year, the Secretary of the Treasury would be required to break up these institutions so that their failure would not lead to the collapse of the U.S. or global economy. We passed a financial reform bill, which I supported and got a major provision in there asking for disclosure of the Fed and an investigation of conflicts of interest at the Fed and an audit of the Fed during the financial crisis. But overall, I by no means think that that legislation went anywhere near far enough. I think it was a modest piece of legislation, and I think that's an issue we've got to revisit. In my view, Mr. President, and I worry very much about the future because I have the feeling in my stomach that that day is going to come around again when these huge financial institutions are tottering, when they're going to go running to Washington and they're going to say, hey, you got to bail us out. In my view, if an institution is too big to fail, it is too big to exist. Let us break them up so that we do not have to go through another bailout of Wall Street. Furthermore, I believe that when you have that kind of concentration of ownership, when you have four large financial institutions holding half the mortgages in this country, controlling two-thirds of the credit cards, and amassing 40% of all deposits, this is not good for a competitive economy. We're supposed to be living in free market capitalism, real competition. This is not free market competition. This is a huge concentration of ownership where a few people have enormous power over the economy and, with their wealth, the political life of this country. No single financial institution should be so large that its failure would cause catastrophic risk to millions of American jobs or to our nation's economic well-being. No single financial institution should have holdings so extensive that its failure could send the world's economy into crisis. We were there 2 years ago, and in many ways, despite the passage of the financial reform bill, we are even more there now. The big, huge financial institutions that we bailed out are bigger, more huge today. And interestingly enough, on that issue, Mr. President, it is not just progressives like myself who hold that view. There's some pretty conservative folks who are honest conservatives. You have at least three Federal Reserve Bank presidents that support breaking up too big to fail banks. James Bullard, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, president and chief executive of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Kansas City Fed president Thomas M. Honig, and Dallas Fed president Richard W. Fisher. These guys don't have my political views. I am a proud progressive. My guess is they're conservatives. But anybody with an ounce of brains in your head understands that four large financial institutions that have assets that are more than half of the GDP of the United States of America places us, A, in a very dangerous position in terms of too big to fail, and B, it is just bad for a competitive economy. Is there any wonder why people are paying 25 or 30% interest rates on their credit cards? That's because these guys issue two-thirds of the credit cards in America. Is there any reason why they were issuing fraudulent mortgage packages to people? Because there is not the kind of competition that should be there. But this is not just Bernie Sanders' point of view. Here is what Kansas City Fed President Honig said, and I quote, "I think they should be broken up. I think there's no reason why, as we've done in other instances, of finding the right mechanism to break them into their components. And in doing so, I think you'll make the financial system itself more stable. And I think you will have long-run benefits over our current system, which mixes it and therefore leads to bailouts when crises occur." End of quote. This is Thomas Honig, the head of the Kansas City Fed. He's absolutely right. But, and I'm going to get to the reason why in a little while, we've not been able to do this. We've not been able to do this because Wall Street sends their lobbyists down here in droves, and Wall Street provides zillions of dollars in campaign contributions, and Wall Street fights like the Dickens to make sure that any strong provisions that some of us might bring up is defeated. Here is what the president of the Dallas Fed, Mr. Fischel, said, quote, "Based on my experience at the Fed, the marginal cost of too-big-to-fail financial institutions easily dwarf their purported social and macroeconomic benefits. The risk posed by coddling too-big-to-fail banks is simply too great." And Mr. Fischel continues, "I think the disagreeable but sound thing to do regarding institutions that are too big to fail is to dismantle them over time into institutions that can be prudently managed and regulated across borders. And this should be done before the next financial crisis, because we now know it surely cannot be done in the middle of a crisis." End of quote. And that's Dallas Fed President Mr. Fischel. Mr. President, they are already in the process of breaking up big banks in England. According to the Washington Post, the British government announced a while back that it will break up parts of major financial institutions bailed out by taxpayers. The British government, spurred on by European regulators, is forcing the Royal Bank of Scotland, Lloyds Banking Group, and Northern Rock to sell off parts of their operations. The Europeans are calling for more and smaller banks to increase competition and eliminate the threat posed by banks so large that they must be rescued by taxpayers, no matter how they conducted their business, in order to avoid damaging the global financial system. Mr. President, very interesting development occurred on October 15th of last year. And as I mentioned earlier, Alan Greenspan, who was the chairman of the Fed before Mr. Bernanke, and I had our run-ins. Mr. Greenspan, along with Mr. Rubin and others, were the chief proponents, Larry Summers in there, were the chief proponents of deregulation of financial institutions. And Mr. Greenspan and I had more than a few arguments. But on October 15th of last year, Alan Greenspan, who admitted that his views on deregulation were wrong, and I give the man courage for at least admitting that he was wrong, did a heck of a lot of damage, but at least he had the courage to admit that he was wrong. He was quoted in Bloomberg News as saying, and I quote, "If they are too big to fail, they are too big. In 1911, we broke up Standard Oil. So what happened? The individual parts became more valuable than the whole. Maybe that's what we need to do." End of quote. Alan Greenspan, the architect of deregulation, citing the fact that in 1911, we broke up Standard Oil. So here you have Greenspan, who helped cause this crisis, at least having the courage to understand that now is the time to begin breaking up these big financial institutions. They have enormous power over our economy. They have enormous power over our political life. Their lobbyists are all over this place. You can't walk down the hall without bumping into some of their lobbyists. So we've got to start breaking them up, and the American people have got to be prepared for a major fight to take on these huge financial institutions. Mr. President, former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, who has advised the Obama administration, supports breaking up big banks so that they no longer pose systemic risk to the entire economy. According to a recent article in the New York Times, Volcker said, and I quote, "People say I'm old-fashioned, and banks can no longer be separated from non-bank activity. That argument brought us to where we are today," end of quote, Paul Volcker. I couldn't agree more. That's what I'm talking about. You've got to start breaking up four financial institutions which led us into the economic disaster we're in right now, that remain much too big to fail, that we're going to have to bail out again and again and again, and that today have a stranglehold on our economy. The New York Times said that under Volcker's plan, quote, J.P. Morgan Chase would have to give up the trading operations acquired from Bear Stearns, Bank of America and Merrill Lynch would go back to being separate companies, Goldman Sachs could no longer be a bank holding company, end of quote. That's exactly what needs to be happening. The reality is, and I come from a small state, we have community banks. Here's the irony, Mr. President. The banks in Vermont, in the midst of all of this financial disaster, they did just fine. They are small, locally owned banks. They know the people they lend money to. The CEOs are not making hundreds of millions of dollars in profit. They know their community. They know what loans made sense. Now, I may be old-fashioned like Mr. Volcker, but I think that's what banking is about, to lend out money to people in the productive economy, the business community that can use the money to spend, create jobs, to homeowners that need that money to buy a home, not to be living in your own world, engaged in a huge gambling casino, producing and selling worthless products that nobody understands. In recent years, what we have seen, incredibly, 40% of all profits in America went to the financial institutions. Small number of people working there, relatively small. 40% of the profits, because it is a huge gambling casino. We need financial institutions to go back to the way banking used to be. And the job of banks is to provide affordable loans to the productive economy so that we can produce real products, real goods, and we can create real jobs when we do that. Robert Reich, President Clinton's former labor secretary, has said, quote, "No important public interest is served by allowing giant banks to grow too big to fail. Wall Street banks should be split up and soon." Got a lot of people, some conservatives, some progressives, are saying the same thing. If we're going to rebuild the middle class, the way to do that is, among other things, to change our disastrous trade policies, to make it clear to corporate America that they cannot continue to sell out the workers of this country by moving to China, other low-wage countries. And we also have got to have a much more competitive economy, one in which four large financial institutions do not own assets of more than half of the GDP of this country. And on that point, I find it very interesting that it's not just progressives like myself or Robert Reich, but you have some conservative bankers, people who are heading Fed banks around this country, who are saying pretty much the same thing.
That was part three of a four-part mini-series with excerpts from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' 8.5-hour filibuster speech in protest of the so-called Tax Relief, Unemployment Insurance Reauthorization and Job Creation Act of 2010. The act also extended tax breaks to the richest of the rich. Come back when Sanders explains how important it is to not only consider our $13.7 trillion national debt and our deficit, which is $1.4 trillion, but also our trade deficit. He says we can't have an economic recovery unless we enact trade reforms. Bernie Sanders was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. Before his 1990 election to Congress, Sanders lectured at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Come back when TUC Radio returns for more gems and intriguing facts from Bernie Sanders' 8.5-hour filibuster speech. He spoke in the Senate on December 10, 2010. Thanks to C-SPAN for the audio from the 8.5-hour video. Links to the video, to Bernie Sanders' Senate webpage, and to the recipients of Federal Reserve largesse are on TUC Radio's website. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelodin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.